But you don't know, do you?
I don't, no. He turned away.
Leave. Paige is missing. I don't care.
In the distance, Simon could hear the scream laughter of children, probably coming from the corn maze. Aaron Corval had grown up here, in this Norman Rockwell painting come to life, and look how it ended up. Then again, in all fairness, hadn't Paige been raised in a slightly altered version of an idyllic childhood? And not just on paper. We all see the picket fences or the pretty facades, the two smiling parents, the healthy siblings, all that. And part of us gets that we have zero idea what's going on behind closed doors, that there is anger and abuse, shattered dreams and blown expectations. But that hadn't been the case with Paige. Were their lives perfect? Of course not. Were their lives pretty close to perfect? As close, Simon imagined, as you get. And yet, their daughter had succumbed to the worst out there. Simon had asked himself a million questions, pondered every decision. Had he shown enough interest, paid attention to her friends and studies, supported her hobbies? Were they too strict or too lax? There was that time Simon had exploded in anger and actually thrown a glass on the floor during dinner. Just once, years ago. He remembered how Paige, only 8 at the time, had started to shiver. Was that to blame? You go through every damn moment like that because even though his mother had warned him, kids don't come with instruction manuals. And you quickly learn that your child comes to you hardwired, that in the battle of nature versus nurture, nature kicks complete and total ass. Still, when things go wrong, when something this dark invades your child's soul, you can only wonder where the hell you went wrong. From behind him, a woman asked, "Who's this?" Simon spun toward the voice. Again, he recognized her from the picture in the foyer, Aaron's mother, Enid. There were people traipsing down the path with her, 10 or 12, Simon estimated, including a man with a clerical collar carrying a Bible.
"Just a nice gentleman who walked down the wrong path," Wiley Corval said.
Simon considered countering that with the truth, full-on confrontation, to hell with niceties. But he concluded that it would probably backfire. He muttered an apology and started past the family and friends and back up toward the farm. There was no one close to Aaron's age here, and Simon remembered Paige telling him something about Aaron being an only child. That meant there'd be no sibling to question, and none of these people looked the right age to be a close friend if indeed a junkie like Aaron had any close friends. So now what? Let them have their service, he thought. Whatever their son had turned into, Wiley and Enid had lost him now, brutally, suddenly, unnaturally, permanently. Give them this moment. When he got back to the clearing, a group of kids, Simon estimated were around 10 or 11 years old, emerged from the maze, breathless. They all started high-fiving each other. Simon pulled out his phone. There were a lot of messages. He went to his favorites. Ingrid was listed first. Yvonne was second, and then Paige, whose number no longer worked, but he still kept it in favorites. Sam, Anya. Age order with the kids. Only fair. He hit Yvonne's number.
"No change," Yvonne said.
"I have to be there with her."
"No, you don't."
He looked back at the kids who just finished the corn maze. They all had their phones out now, some taking photos, both selfies and group shots, others doing whatever it was we all do on those screens.
"Reverse roles," Yvonne said. "You're the one shot. You're the one lying here in a coma. Do you want Ingrid sitting next to you and holding your hand?"
Or, "Yeah, okay, I get it."
"So have you found Aaron's family?"
He filled her in on what had just occurred.
"So what's your plan?"
"Hang here. Wait until the service is over. Try to talk to them again."
"The father doesn't sound amenable," Yvonne said. "A mother might be more understanding."
"Sexist," he said.
"Yep."
"How are things at work?"
"We got you covered."
Simon hung up and moved back to his car. He took out his phone again and started to listen to the messages. Word about the shooting had somehow not yet made the papers, so most of the messages were mercifully client rather than solace-related. He returned some of the client calls, not mentioning his own situation, making it just another workday. Doing something routine was comforting. He was blocking on Ingrid, he knew that. But he also knew that was the right way to go right now. Half an hour later, while discussing with Dr. Daniel Brocklehurst, a neurosurgeon at Mount Sinai, the financial benefits of retiring in Florida versus Arizona, Simon spotted the mourners coming back over the gentle hill. They were led by Wiley Corval and the clergyman. Wiley's back was bent over in apparent, if not melodramatic, grief, and the clergyman had his arm around his shoulders, whispering what Simon assumed were words of comfort. The other mourners trailed them, some squinting up into the sun, others nodding to passing tourists. In the back of the group, way in the back, come to think of it, was Enid Corval, Aaron's mother. For a brief flash, Simon imagined them as a pack of gazelles and him the lion, readying to take down the one farthest away from the pack. Silly image, but there you go. But that one would be Enid, the mother. Simon kept watching. Enid looked distracted. She glanced at her watch, slowing her walk, staying farther and farther back from the rest of the mourners. Alone. Odd, Simon thought. She was the mother. You'd think a few of them would be with her, putting an arm around her, offering her comforting words. No one did. She was also dressed differently. The rest of the group, including Wiley Corval, had gone with the blue blazer, khaki, loafer sans socks spirit, even if that wasn't exactly what they were wearing. Poor man's yacht club. Enid wore mom jeans, Velcro white sneakers, and a stretched-out cable-knit sweater that was a yellow, usually found on a Ticonderoga pencil. Wiley and the clergyman started up the porch steps. The receptionist, who'd helped Simon, greeted Wiley at the door with a bus on the cheek. The rest of the mourners filed in after him. Except Enid. She was now trailing the group far enough that she remained outside after the door had closed. She glanced left, then right, then headed behind the inn. Simon wasn't sure what his move was here. Get out of the car and confront? Stay where he was and see where she was going? When Enid Corval disappeared around the back of the inn, Simon slid out of the car to get a better view. He spotted her getting into a pickup truck. She started it up and put the truck into reverse. Simon hurried back to his car and hit the ignition button. 30 seconds later, he was following Enid Corval's pickup down Tom Wheeler Road. The road was lined with low stone walls, offering a modicum of protection to the vast farmland on both sides. Simon didn't know enough about this area. Were these real farms, or for show, or what? But most looked pretty worn and dilapidated. 15 minutes later, the pickup truck pulled into a dirt parking lot with like-minded vehicles. There was no sign visible advertising a name or description for this establishment. Enid got out of the pickup and headed toward a converted barn with aluminum siding, like it had been snapped together. The color was faux bright orange, like a clown's hair. Simon pulled in, self-conscious of his Audi, and cruised to a far corner. He looked to his left. Hidden from the road on the far side of the barn were a couple of dozen motorcycles lined up in two anally straight lines, Harley-Davidsons for the most part. Simon didn't know much about motorcycles, had never been on one, but even from this vantage point, he could spot the iconic Harley logo on a few of the bikes. Enid was heading across the dirt lot for the saloon-style doors. Two husky men in leather chaps and black bandanas stumbled into the lot as she arrived. Their thick, somewhat flabby arms were loaded with tats. Both sported paunches and the prerequisite beard. Bikers. They greeted Enid warmly with handshakes and hugs. She kissed one on the cheek and disappeared inside. Simon debated waiting for her to come back out. This place clearly wasn't his usual hangout, but that seemed like a waste of time. He turned off his car and started for the swinging doors. When he pushed them open, he somehow expected that the music would stop and everyone would turn and stare at the interloper. But no one did. There was also no music playing. A television old enough for rabbit ears showed a baseball game. The bar was odd. Too wide in spots, space enough for a dance, maybe, but Simon doubted there'd been one recently. There was a jukebox in the right corner, but it was unplugged. The floor beneath him was mostly dirt, the same as the parking lot. Enid Corval took a seat at the bar. Considering it was only 11 a.m., business seemed pretty brisk. There were maybe 10 people scattered amongst the 30 or so stools, equally spaced apart, no one right next to anyone else, like men's urinals in a public bathroom. They all huddled over their drink, eyes down in protective, don't-converse-with-me mode. A group of bikers on the right played pool on a table with ugly rips in the green fabric. There were cans of Pabst Blue Ribbon everywhere. Simon sported a dress shirt, tie, and black loafers. He had, after all, been heading to a memorial service, while half the guys in here wore cotton gym tanks with no sleeves, a look no man over 40 should ever try, no matter how well built. And these guys weren't well built. Hats off to them, Simon thought, for not caring. He took a stool two away from Enid. She didn't look up from her drink or glance his way. On the other side of him, a guy wearing a pork pie hat was bouncing his head up and down as though to music, but no music was playing and he wasn't wearing earphones. A rainbow of rusted license plates took up most of the back wall, probably plates representing all 50 states, but Simon wasn't really up for checking. There were neon signs for Miller High Life and Schlitz. An oddly ornate chandelier hung from the ceiling. This place, like the inn, was all dark wood, but that was the only similarity, like this was the poorest of poor cousins of the inn's rich dark wood.
"What'll you have?"
The barmaid's hair was the color and texture of the hay on that hayride, and done in a quasi-mullet that reminded Simon of an 80s hockey player. She was either a hard 45 or a soft 65, and there was little question she had seen it all at least twice.
"What kind of beer do you have?" he asked.
"We have Pabst and Pabst.
You choose for me." Enid still had her eye on her drink, not so much as glancing in his direction when she said,
"Your pages, Dad."
"Wiley tell you?" She shook her head, still not looking at him.
He didn't say a word. "Why did you come today?"
"To pay my respects." "That's a lie."
"Yeah, it is. But I am sorry for your loss."
She didn't react to or acknowledge that.
"So why are you here?"
"My daughter is missing." The barmaid opened the can and plopped it in front of him. Enid finally turned her head toward him.
"Since when?"
"Since Aaron's murder."
"That can't be a coincidence."
"I agree."
"Your daughter probably killed him and ran."
Just like that. No emotion in her voice. "Would it matter," Simon said, "if I said I don't think that's the case?" Enid made a maybe yes, maybe no gesture.
"You gamble at all?"
"No."
"Yeah, but you're some big stockbroker or something, right?"
"I do financial advising."
"Yeah, whatever. You still play the odds, right? Try to figure out what's safe and what's risky, all that?"
Simon nodded.
"So you know what the two most likely possibilities are, don't you?"
"Tell me."
"One, your daughter killed Aaron and is on the run."
"And two?"
"Whoever killed Aaron took or killed her, too."
Enid Crevalle took a sip of her drink.
"Come to think of it, possibility two is much more likely."
"What makes you say that?" Simon asked.
"Junkies aren't great at not leaving clues or eluding the police."
"So you don't think she killed him?"
"I didn't say that."
"Let's assume you're right," Simon said, trying to stay methodical here, detached. "Why would someone take Paige?"
"No clue. Hate to say this, but odds are she's dead."
She took another sip. "I'm still not sure why you're here." "I'm hoping you know something."
"I haven't seen Aaron in months."
"Do you recognize this guy?" Simon handed her his phone.
Elena Ramirez had texted him a photograph of her client's missing son, Henry Thorpe. "Who is he?"
"His name is Henry Thorpe. He's from Chicago." She shook her head.
"I don't know him. Why?"
"He may be connected into this."
"Into this how?"
"I don't have a clue. It's why I'm here. He's missing."
"Like Paige?"
I guess.
Can't help you, I'm afraid.
A scowling biker with a shaved head pulled out the stool between them so he could lean on the bar. Simon noticed the black iron cross tattoo and maybe a half swastika sticking out from under his shirt sleeve. The biker noticed him noticing and stared him hard in the eye. Simon stared back and felt the red start to rise.
What are you looking at? Biker boy said.
Simon did not blink or move.
I asked you,
Enid said. He's with me.
Hey, Enid, I didn't mean...
And you're interrupting a private conversation.
I mean, how was I supposed to know?
Biker boy sounded scared.
I was just getting some beers, Enid.
That's fine. Gladys will bring them over to you. You wait over by the pool table.
And with that, biker boy was gone.
Enid, Simon said. Yeah.
What is this place?
Private club.
Yours?
You here to ask about your daughter or about me?
I'm just trying to figure this all out.
What out? Do you mind telling me about Aaron? What about him?
I don't know anything. Everything.
Can't much see the purpose.
There are threads here, he said, the words sounding weird coming from his mouth even to him. Connections. I don't know what they are, but I feel like I'm missing something. So I'm asking questions and plowing ahead and hoping. She frowned.
You're gonna have to do better than that.
My wife was shot yesterday, Simon said. Enid looked a question at him. She's alive, but we were looking for Paige, where they lived, where Aaron was killed. He told her the story, taking chugs of the Pabst as he went along. Simon couldn't remember the last time he drank a cold beer this early in the day, but today, in this place, it felt right. Simon glanced around the room as he spoke. Biker boy wasn't the only one with white supremacist tattoos. A number of guys had swastikas, and yeah, he was outnumbered, and he had bigger fish to fry at the moment. But this was America now, his country, this crap just out in the open and accepted, and he could feel his blood boil despite it all.
You saw where Aaron grew up, Enid said when he finished,
on that farm.
It's not really a farm, it's a tourist spot, but yeah, nice, right?
Seems so.
Seems so,
she repeated with a nod. When Aaron was little, he lived in the actual inn. Back then, they only rented out 6 rooms. The family lived in the rest. Then they grew, started renting out all 10 rooms. 5, 6 years ago, we built those additions. So now it's up to 24 rooms. We got a pretty good restaurant, too. Wiley always calls it a bistro, thinks it sounds fancier. And the gift shop does a nice business. Sells souvenirs and candles, junk like that. I'm getting off topic, aren't I?
Not at all.
You want to know about Aaron?
Simon didn't reply.
Well, Aaron, even as a kid, he was always a little dark, if you know what I mean.
One of the tattoo guys met her eye by a back door. Enid nodded, and the guy slipped out.
I don't see how any of this could possibly help you, she said.
They.
What?
You said they only rented out 6 rooms, they.
So?
I'd think you'd say we instead of they.
No we yet, she said. Wiley and I weren't married back then.
Back when?
When Wiley lived in the original inn.
But you said Aaron lived there.
Yeah, with Wiley. I'm his stepmom. I wasn't on the scene until he was 9. Truth be told, I'm not the maternal type.
Surprised, right? Aaron and me,
we were never close.
And his real mom, where is she?
Enid glanced at the back door. The tattoo man came back in, making sure that Enid had spotted him. Her glass was empty. Gladys, with the hay hair, filled it without being told.
Mrs. Corval, Simon said. Call me Enid.
Enid,
what happened to Aaron's real mother?
It has nothing to do with any of this.
It might.
How?
Enid turned now, placing one arm on the bar, and faced him full on. I mean, I told Aaron from day one in here, you don't try it. Not ever. Not a taste. He saw every day what that crap does to you. Still, he ended up murdered in a junkie-infested shithole. So tell me, Mr. Green,
How could his birth mom have anything to do with Aaron ending up like that? And while you're at it, how could his birth mom have anything to do with your daughter vanishing into the wind?
I don't know, Simon said.
I'd probably be more the one to blame, don't you think? Simon said nothing. His dad and I get married. When he's a teen, he wants to start hanging out here. That's the problem with growing up in a quiet place. People think it's magical or some shit. Beauty bores. It traps. Someone like Aaron, he's got that edge in him, just the way he is. Like me, even though we aren't blood. He wanted to ask what this place was, but that would be the wrong way to go. He shifted gears and asked, "Was Aaron's birth mother at the service today?" Enid kept her head down. "Can't you at least tell me?" "No," Enid said. "She wasn't there." "Is she still alive? Did she have any kind of relationship with her son?"
"I don't know you, Mr. Green."
"Yeah, you do. I mean, you know enough. I don't care what you do here or what's going on with the inn or any of that. I don't mean you the least bit of trouble. But at the risk of sounding one note, my daughter is missing.
And I don't see how that has anything to do with..."
"It probably doesn't," he interrupted. "Except that's not how it feels, does it? The police think maybe Paige killed Aaron to save herself, or maybe I did it, or my wife, to protect our child. Or maybe it was a drug deal gone wrong. Those are all good theories, but I'm asking for your help." She started swirling her glass, her eyes on the liquor. "Is Aaron's mother alive or not?"
"The truth?"
Enid looked up and studied his face for a very long time. "I don't know." "You don't know if she's alive or dead?"
"That's right."
Enid turned to Gladys. "Get my friend here another beer and bring it to the corner booth. He and I need to talk for a bit." Chapter 16. The entrance to Tattoos While You Wait was blocked off with old-school A-frame traffic barricades, the kind with slanted reflective orange and white stripes running across the horizontal beam. Elena Ramirez spotted two fully emblazoned police cars plus two other vehicles that looked to be unmarked. She pulled her rental Ford Fusion with the overbearing cherry scent into the tattoo parlor's entry between the highway and the barricades. A cop frowned and started toward her.
"You'll need to leave."
"What's going on here? Please remove your car from the premises." Elena could wave her credentials, but they probably wouldn't get her anyplace. She also had no idea what the situation was or why the police were here, and it was never a good idea to go in blind. Time to do a little recon. Elena thanked the officer, put the car in reverse, and got back onto the highway. She pulled off 100 yards down the road at a Sonic drive-in. She took out her phone and made some calls. It took maybe half an hour to get the details on the double murder from the day before. The two victims were Damian Gorse, age 29, co-owner of the parlor, and 18-year-old Ryan Bailey, a high school senior who worked there part-time. The initial report indicated that the two victims had been shot in a robbery gone wrong. Wrong, Elena thought to herself, being the operative word. She made a few more calls, waited, got the confirmation. Then she headed back down the highway and pulled up to those barricades. The same police officer moved one of them aside so that she could pass. He pointed for her to park on the left. She nodded a thanks and did as requested. Elena looked in her rearview mirror and tried on a sympathetic, "We're all in this together" smile. Meh. This part would be a pain in the ass. Cops and egos, tough recipe. Add in a dollop of territorial bullshit and customary dick-swinging, plus the rarity of landing a single murder case, let alone a double murder, and Elena expected a shit show of epic proportions. A man Elena figured was mid-30s, maybe 40, came out of the tattoo parlor's front entrance, pulled off his crime scene gloves, and headed toward her. His stride was confident, but not cocky. The guy was good-looking as hell. More lumberjack than pretty boy, what they used to call rugged, if she still had a type, and Elena had felt dead in that area since Joel's death, this guy would be it. The cop gave her a nod and a tight smile, an appropriate greeting under the circumstances. "You must be Special Agent Ramirez," the man said.
"Retired."
She shook his hand. His hand was big. like Joel's. She felt another pang.
I'm Detective Dumas. Everybody calls me Nap.
Nap, she repeated, like a short sleep, yes.
I'm Elena. I work private now.
Yeah, my boss filled me in.
Would that be County Prosecutor Lauren Muse?
It would.
I hear she's good.
Yeah, Knapp said. She is.
No resentment in his tone at having a young woman over him. No faux virtual signaling over it either. Good signs. Here was how it worked. Elena's firm, VMB Investigations, was one of the most prestigious in the country, with offices in Chicago, New York, Los Angeles, and Houston. Investigators like those at VMB need access, so they donate generously to political campaigns and police benevolent groups of various stripes. One of her senior partners, Manny Andrews, was a big backer of the current governor. That governor is the one who named Lauren Muse county prosecutor. So Manny Andrews calls the governor calls Muse, Muse in turn calls the lead detective on the case, Nap Dumas. The message? Cooperate. Nothing illegal. If you gasp at this sort of favor exchanging, you are hopelessly naive. The world had always been a place of you scratch my back and I'll scratch yours. When that breaks down, for better or worse, so does your society. Cops often bristled at this particular back scratch, however, which leads to the territorial dick swinging Elena had braced for. Nap Dumas seemed okay with it. For now.
Follow me, he said.
He began walking to the left side of the building. Elena, who still had the limp from a long-ago bullet, caught up with him.
I just took over the case an hour ago, Nap said, so I'm still catching up myself.
I appreciate you letting me on the scene. A small, knowing smile came to Dumas's lips.
No problem.
Elena didn't bother with a follow-up.
Any chance you could tell me you're interested in this?
I have a case, Elena said. There may be an overlap.
Whoa, Dumas said. Let's go easy on the specifics.
She smiled at that. Up ahead, Elena spotted a wood-paneled Ford Flex. Two crime scene technicians dressed all in white worked the scene.
Can you tell me what kind of case? He asked.
She pondered playing hardball, reminding him that his boss had already told him to cooperate, and that she couldn't talk about her case because it was work product. But that felt wrong here. This Nap guy seemed all right. More than that, actually. Good aura, Elena's mother would tell her. Elena had always been skeptical of that stuff, first impressions, gut instincts, because, let's face it, people can be complete psychos and fool you. But in truth, they rarely fooled Elena. As the years had gone on, she realized that her gut worked better than she imagined. The guys who gave her the creeps off the bat, they always ended up being creeps. The guys, the very few guys, who gave off this kind of positive aura, they ended up being trustworthy. And Nap reminded her of Joel. Her Joel. God help her. The pang moved to her heart and stayed there. Nap? He waited.
I think it's better if we wait, Elena said.
Oh?
I'm not going to keep anything from you, Elena said. But right now I'd like to hear what you think, without any preconceptions.
Preconceptions, Dumas repeated.
Yes.
You mean like context and facts?
You seem like a straight shooter.
As do you.
Can we just play it my way for now?
Nap hesitated, but not for very long. He nodded his okay as they reached the Ford Flex and started right in. The way we see it, the first shooting took place here, as Damien Gorse was getting in his car.
So Gorse was shot first?
We're pretty sure, yeah. Nap tilted his head.
Is that important?
She didn't reply.
He sighed.
Right. Preconceptions.
How many shooters? Elena asked.
We don't know, but initial ballistics indicate the same gun killed both victims.
So maybe there was only one.
Hard to say, but it feels that way. Elena took in the scene. She looked at the back of the building and then up toward the sky.
No security cameras in the parking lot.
None.
How about inside?
Also none. Just a routine ADT alarm with a panic button and motion detector.
I assume the business takes cash?
Yes.
What do they do with it?
One of the two owners, and Gorse was one of them,
takes the cash home every night and stores it in their safe.
Their safe?
Pardon?
You said their safe. Two owners share a safe?
They live together, yeah. And to answer your next question, Gorse was robbed. The cash, his wallet, some of his jewelry were gone.
So you're thinking robbery?
Knapp gave her a crooked smile, again like Joel's. Damn.
Well, I was, he said.
The implication was clear. I was, until you showed up.
So where's the co-owner, she asked.
On his way from the airport. He should be here any minute.
Airport?
His name is Neil Raff. He was on vacation in Miami.
Is he a suspect?
A business partner taking a trip during the time of a murder?
Right, she said. So, of course, he is.
Like I said, it's early.
Any idea how much cash Gorse had on him?
Not yet, no. Some days, we've been told, it could be as high as a few $1,000s. Some days, it could be next to nothing. Depends, obviously, on how business was that day and how many people used plastic.
There was no chalk drawing of a body or any of that stuff, but Knapp had crime scene photographs. Elena studied them for a moment. Do you think the perp robbed Gorse first and then shot him, Elena began, or shot him first and then robbed him?
Shot him first, Knapp said.
You seem pretty certain.
Look at Gorse's pocket in the photograph.
She did, nodding.
Turned inside out. Also the shirt untucked, one ring left on like it's been too difficult to get off, or someone interrupted him.
Elena saw it now. Where was the shooter standing?
Knapp showed her. The first cops on the scene figured that the shooter had just driven in and fired from his car, or that maybe he'd parked and waited.
You're not buying that.
It could be, Knapp said. But my bet is the shooter came out from the woods. Look at this angle.
Elena nodded.
It's possible, Knapp continued, that the killer could have driven in earlier, parked, and then hidden in the woods. But I don't think so.
Why not?
Because there was only one other person here at the time of the shooting, the second victim, Ryan Bailey. Bailey doesn't own a car. He takes the bus from the mall and walks. She glanced around, subtracted out the cop cars, both marked and unmarked.
So when the first responders got here, were any cars in the lot other than Gorse's?
None, Knapp said. The lot was empty.
Elena stood back up. So if someone, say the killer, drove in and parked in the lot, Gorse would have noticed it when he left.
Agree, Knapp said. Damien Gorse is the owner. It's closing time. If a strange car is in his lot, I think he'd walk over and check it out. Unless there was a getaway driver.
Elena frowned. Getaway driver?
I use all the cool cop lingo. Either way, we will go through all relevant nearby CCTV footage.
I understand one of the two victims called 911.
Ryan Bailey, the second victim.
What did he say on the call?
Nothing.
Nothing?
Knapp explained his working theory.
The shooter kills Damien Gorse by the Ford Fusion. The shooter starts going through the dead man's pockets, takes the money, the watch, the wallet.
And he is pulling off Gorse's jewelry when the door opens and Ryan Bailey comes out. Bailey sees what's happening, runs back inside, hits the alarm, and hides in the closet.
Elena frowned.
What? Knapp asked.
Bailey sets off an alarm inside the tattoo parlor?
Knapp nodded. The panic button is right near the back door.
Is it a silent alarm? She asked.
No.
Loud?
The alarm? Yeah, really loud.
Elena frowned again.
What?
Show me, she said.
Show you what?
Inside. The closet where Ryan Bailey hid.
Knapp studied her for a moment.
Then he handed her a pair of crime scene gloves. She snapped them on. He did the same.
They walked toward the back entrance. Full garbage bag, Knapp said, pointing to one lying split on the ground. We figured Bailey came out to throw it in the dumpster.
And that was when he interrupted the robbery.
That's our theory.
Except it didn't make sense.
Another cop handed them each a white crime scene suit with footies. Elena slipped hers on over her suit. All white. They both looked like giant sperms. There were more white-covered lab guys inside. The closet was adjacent to the back door.
Elena frowned again.
What?
It doesn't add up.
Why not?
You figure Ryan Bailey came outside to throw away the garbage.
Right.
He spots our killer looting Gorse's body.
Right. So our perp didn't know the kid was inside. That's most likely.
I don't know, probably. So what?
So Ryan Bailey goes outside, he spots the killer. He runs back in and hits the alarm. Then he hides in the closet.
Right.
And our killer is in hot pursuit, right?
Right.
So our killer follows him inside. The killer searches for him. All the while, this alarm is blaring.
Yeah, so?
Why? She asked.
What do you mean, why? Ryan Bailey had spotted the killer. He could identify him.
So our killer wanted to silence him?
Yes.
So that sort of rules out a professional hit job, Elena said.
How so?
Do you know any pro that wouldn't have been wearing a ski mask or some kind of disguise? A pro would have run when the alarm went off. Because what could the kid tell us? A man wearing a ski mask killed his boss? That's it. The only reason the killer would follow him in and kill him is that Ryan Bailey could identify him. Knapp nodded. Or maybe it was someone they both knew. Either way, Elena said, I don't think it fits with my case. My guy would be a pro. He'd use a mask.
So what is your case?
And then she spotted the computer on top of the counter. She didn't know who Henry Thorpe had been in touch with, just that the communications came from an IP address and Wi-Fi located in this building. Elena turned to Knapp. Can I take a look at that computer?
Chapter 17. Enid Corval and Simon were comfortably ensconced on the ripped fabric of a corner booth in this private club. Simon had already put most of it together. Not about Aaron's mother, he had no idea about that, but about this club. They were selling something out back, drugs, probably. This wasn't a pub or bar, it was a private club, different regulations. The inn was her front, her legitimacy, and probably where she laundered a lot of money from here. He might, of course, be way off in his assumptions. His theorizing, if you wanted to call it that, didn't even raise itself to the level of flimsy conjecture. But either way, he wasn't going to bring it up unless he absolutely needed to. But the theory felt right to him.
Wiley and me, our marriage is kind of old-fashioned.
She stopped, shook her head.
Don't know why I'm telling you this. I'm getting older, I guess. Aaron is dead, and maybe you're right, Mr. Green.
Simon.
I prefer Mr. Green.
Maybe I'm right about what?
Enid spread her hands.
Maybe it's all related. That stuff in the past and now? Who am I to say?
Simon waited, but not long. Enid dove in.
I'm not from around here. I grew up in Billings, Montana. You don't need to hear the tale of how I ended up in this part of Connecticut. The winds blow as they do. That's life. But when I met Wiley, he had a 9-year-old son named Aaron. A lot of women found all that attractive, the single father thing. Raising the boy on his own, the beautiful inn and farm. Someone would ask Wiley about the boy and what happened to his mother, but he'd politely shake them off, didn't like to talk about it. Used to get a tear in his eye, even with me.
But eventually...
Oh, I'd heard the story before he told me. Everyone around here knew parts of it. Wiley and the boy's mother met during a time in his life when he didn't want anything to do with the inn. Like everyone else who grows up here, Wiley longed to escape. So he started backpacking through Europe and met a girl in Italy. Her name was Bruna. Tuscany. That was what Wiley told me. The two worked in a vineyard for a while. He said working in the vineyard was a little like working on the inn. It reminded him of it anyway. Made him long for home a little. That's what he said.
She gestured at the Pabst can with her chin.
You're not drinking your beer.
I have to drive.
Two beers? Come on. You're not that big a girl.
But he was. Ingrid could drink hard liquor for hours and show no signs of it. Simon had two beers and tried to French kiss a light socket. So what happened?
They fell in love, Wiley and Bruna. Romantic, right? They had a boy, Aaron. A blissful story until, well, Bruna died.
She died? Enid kept still. Too still.
How?
He asked.
Car accident.
Head-on collision on Autostrada A11, and yeah, Wiley always added that detail, Autostrada A11. I looked it up once. Don't know why. It connects Pisa to Florence. Bruna was going to visit her family, he said, and he didn't want to go. They had a fight about it before she left. See, Wiley was supposed to have been in the car with her. That's what he said, so he blames himself. It's very hard for him to talk about. He gets all choked up. She looked at him over her glass. You sound skeptical, Simon said. Do I? Yes. Wiley tells the story with gusto. He's quite theatrical, my husband. You'd believe every word.
You didn't?
Oh, I believed it. But see, I also wondered why Bruna would go to visit her family and not bring her infant son. You'd do that, right? You're a young mom traveling the, she made quote marks with her fingers, Autostrada to see your family, you'd take your baby.
Did you ask Wiley about that?
No, I never said anything. I mean, why would I? Who'd question a story like that?
There was a chill in the stale beer air. Simon wanted to ask a follow-up, but more than that, he wanted Enid to tell it. He kept silent.
Wiley came back home after the accident. Here. The inn, I mean. He was afraid that maybe Bruna's family would sue for custody or hold him up. They'd never been legally married or anything, so he flew to the States with the baby. They moved into the inn. Her voice faded out as she shrugged. End of the story.
So, Simon said, Aaron's mother is dead.
That's what Wiley says.
But when I asked you if she was alive, you said you didn't know.
You're a quick one, Mr. Green.
She raised her glass and smiled.
Why the hell am I telling you any of this? She stared at him and waited for an answer.
Because I have an honest face, Simon tried.
You look like my first husband.
Was he honest?
Shit, no. Then, but oh man, he was great in bed.
So we have something in common.
Enid snorted. I like you, Mr. Green. And what the hell. I can't see how it'll help you, and yet I've seen some strange shit. And bad stays. Bad doesn't go away. You bury bad, it digs itself out. You throw bad in the middle of the ocean, it comes back at you like a tidal wave.
Simon just waited.
Do you keep your old passports? She asked him. I mean, after they're expired.
Yes.
In fact, Simon advised his clients to do the same, just in case they ever needed to prove they'd been someplace. He was big on saving any official paperwork, because you never knew. So does Wiley. Not where someone could easily find them. They're boxed up in storage in the basement. But I found them. And you know what?
What?
Enid put her hand to the side of her mouth and stage whispered, Wiley has never been to Italy.
The office at Tattoos While You Wait was glass enclosed, so whoever sat in it could look out at the chairs and the artists and the waiting area and vice versa. The computer's monitor faced a wall, however, so that while privacy was pretty much non-existent, you couldn't see what the person sitting at the desk may have been surfing or browsing or whatever people call it nowadays. The desk was partner style, so that two people could sit facing each other. The top was cluttered with scraps of paper, three pairs of drugstore reading glasses, a dozen or so assorted pens and markers. There was a big bag of cherry cough drops on the left, a few paperback books, bills strewn about with no reason or guiding principle behind them. In the center of the desk, facing the glass, was a slightly faded photograph of six men with huge smiles. Two were up front, with arms around each other's shoulders, the other four slightly behind them with folded arms. It had been snapped in front of the parlor, opening day from the looks of the ribbons and the oversized faux scissors. The clothes, the facial hair, the poses, the whole vibe made it feel like a Doobie Brothers album cover. Elena picked up the photograph and showed it to Knapp. Knapp nodded and pointed to the guy in the front on the right.
That's the victim, Damien Gorse.
Knapp slid his finger toward the guy next to him, a hefty dude in full leather motorcycle wear and a salt-and-pepper handlebar mustache.
That's the partner, Neil Raff.
Elena sat in the swivel chair in front of the monitor. The computer's mouse was red and in the shape of a heart. For a moment, Elena just stared at it. A heart. Damien Gorse's computer mouse was in the shape of a heart. As an investigator, you keep your head down and you think analytically because that was often the best. You focus on your particular goal, in this case finding Henry Thorpe. But Joel had always told her not to forget the devastation, the lives lost, or destroyed, or irrevocably torn apart. Damien Gorse had sat in this chair and used this heart-shaped mouse. The heart-shaped mouse was a gift. It had to be. It was not the kind of thing you buy for yourself. And the person who gave it to him wanted Damien to know that he was in some way loved. "Don't let those emotions cloud you," Joel would tell her. "Let them fuel you." When Elena touched the mouse, the screen lit up. A photograph appeared of Damien Gorse and Neil Raff, with an older woman between the two. They were on a beach somewhere, all smiles. In the center of the screen was a box asking for a password. Elena looked over at Knapp as if he might know. He shrugged, "No idea," at her. There were post-it notes all over the computer. She scanned them for what might be a password, but nothing jumped out at her. She opened the top drawer. Nothing. "You have someone who can crack this?" she asked.
"Yeah, but he's not here yet."
The front door flew open, and a man she recognized from the photograph as Neil Raff burst into his own tattoo parlor. The outfit was denim now rather than leather, almost more dated than in the photograph, and the handlebar mustache was now full-on salt. But there was no mistaking him for anyone else. Dazed, he turned his head and looked about his own business as though seeing it for the first time through red-tinged, swollen from crying eyes. Knapp hurried over to the man. Elena watched. Knapp put a hand on the man's shoulder and lowered his head and talked softly. Knapp was good. Again, something in the way Knapp carried himself brought on Joel's echo. It stirred her. God, she missed Joel. Every part of him. She missed the conversations, the company, the heart. But right now she couldn't help but think of how much she missed the sex. This may sound odd to some, but making love to Joel was the greatest thing she would ever do. She missed the weight of him on her. She missed the way he looked at her when he was inside her, as if she were the only woman on God's green earth. She missed, and this wasn't very feminist of her, the way Joel towered over her and made her feel safe. She was thinking this because it suddenly dawned on her, as she looked at the photographs of Gorse and Raff, as she thought back to what Knapp had said about the owners taking the cash home to their safe, and as she watched the devastation on the face of Neil Raff, that she recognized this particular grief, the gut-wrenching, all-consuming devastation of losing a life partner rather than a friend or business partner. She could be projecting, but she didn't think so. Knapp got Raff seated on a leather couch in the waiting area. He wheeled over a chair and sat right in front of the grieving man. Knapp had a notepad in his hand, but he didn't want to risk appearing anything less than completely focused and sympathetic, so he took no notes. Elena waited. There wasn't much else to do. Half an hour later, after she offered her condolences, Elena moved the heart-shaped mouse again, waking up the screen. The photograph appeared.
"Oh, God," Raff said. He turned to Knapp. "Has anyone told Carrie?"
"Carrie?"
"Damien's mother. Oh, my God, she's going to be devastated."
"How could we reach her?"
"Let me call her."
Knapp didn't reply to that. Raff said,
"She lives in a condo in Scottsdale now, on her own. Damien is all she has."
"Is," Elena thought, "is all she has." Still using present tense. Common.
"Did Damien have siblings?" Knapp asked.
"No siblings. Carrie couldn't have kids. Damien was adopted."
"And his father?"
"Out of the picture. His parents had a nasty divorce when he was 3. His adoptive father hasn't been part of Damien's life since."
Elena pointed to the white box on the screen. "Do you know Damien's password?"
Raff blinked and looked away. "Of course I know his password."
"Could you tell me what it is?"
He blinked some more, his eyes brimming with tears.
Guanacaste.
He spelled it for her.
It's a province in Costa Rica, Raph said.
Oh, Elena said, because she wasn't sure what else to say.
We honeymooned there. It's our favorite spot.
Elena hit the return key and waited for the icons to appear on the screen.
What are you looking for? Raph asked.
This was Damien's computer?
It's our computer, yes.
Again with the present tense. Are there any more computers on your network, she asked.
No.
How about clients? Could they access your network?
No. It's password protected.
And this is the only computer on it?
Yes. Damien and I shared it, though I'm not really good with technology. Sometimes I would sit here and use it, and then Damien would sit on the other side of the desk, but most of the time it was Damien's.
Elena was not great with technology either. That was why her firm had Lou, but she knew the basics. She brought up the browser and started checking the history. Neil Raff had been in Miami for the past 5 days, so all the recent surfing would have been done by Damien Gorse.
I still don't understand what you're looking for, Raff said.
There were a lot of image searches. She clicked on a random few. They were, as one might expect, tattoos, a wide variety of them. There were roses and barbed wire tattoos, skeletons with crossbones, hearts of all shades and sizes. There was one tattoo of Pennywise the Clown from Stephen King's It, and several involving full-on sex acts, including, all fours. Who actually got that as a tattoo? And there were ones that said Mom, and ones of tombstones for friends who died, and full-arm sleeves and lots of wing designs for the lower back, what they used to call, maybe still do, tramp stamps.
We get ideas from the images, Raff said. We show the clients what's been done so we can take it to the next level.
The rest of the browser history looked equally routine. Damien Gorse had visited Rotten Tomatoes and bought movie tickets. He'd bought socks and K-cup coffee pods from Amazon. He visited one of those DNA sites that tell you your ancestral makeup. Elena often thought about taking one of those tests. Her mother was Mexican and swore Elena's biological father was, too, but he died before she was born, and Mom always acted funny when Elena would ask, so who knew?
Maybe I can help, Raff asked.
It was more of a plea than a question. Elena kept her eyes on the screen. Do you, or really did Damien, know someone named Henry Thorpe? He thought about it.
Not that I can think of.
He's 24 years old from Chicago.
Chicago? Raff thought some more. I don't think I know anyone with that name, and I never heard Damien mention him either. Why do you ask?
Elena blew through his question. Have you and Damien been to Chicago recently?
I went there when I was a senior in high school. I don't think Damien's ever been.
How about the name Aaron Corval? Does that ring any bells? Raff petted the handlebar mustache with his right hand.
No, I don't think so. Is he also from Chicago?
Connecticut. But he lives in the Bronx now.
Sorry, no. Can I ask why you're asking?
It would be better right now if you could just answer my questions.
Well, I don't recognize either name. I could search our customer database if you'd like.
That would be great. Raff reached over her shoulder and started typing. Knapp said, can you print the full client list for us?
You think one of our clients? Just covering all bases, Knapp said. How do you spell Thorpe? Raff asked Elena.
She suggested that he try it both ways, with the E and without the E. Nothing. Same with Aaron Corval.
Who are these men? Raff asked.
There was an edge there now.
What do they have to do with Damien?
You said only you and Mr. Gorse used this IP and Wi-Fi?
Yeah, so?
Don't ask me for the technical explanation, she said. But Henry Thorpe had contact with someone using this computer's IP. Knapp just listened.
Meaning? Raff said.
There was more edge now.
Meaning just that. Someone who used this computer communicated with Henry Thorpe.
So? This Thorpe guy could be an ink salesman for all I know.
He's not. Elena stared at him hard.
Damien didn't keep secrets from me, Raff said.
Didn't. Finally, the past tense.
Maybe our computer was hacked or something.
That's not what happened, Neil.
So what are you insinuating?
I'm not insinuating anything, I'm asking.
Damien wouldn't cheat on me!
She hadn't really been going there, but maybe she should. Maybe there was some kind of romantic connection here. Was Henry Thorpe gay? She hadn't bothered to ask. Then again, who in this day and age cares? And if that was the case, if Damien and Henry were lovers, how did Aaron Corval fit into this? Wasn't Paige Green his girlfriend? Could that be tied in somehow? Could there be some kind of romantic entanglement Elena hadn't yet considered at the center of this? She didn't see how. Knapp tapped her on the shoulder. Can I speak to you for a moment? Elena got up from the chair. She put a hand on Raff's shoulder. Mr. Raff, he looked at her. I'm not insinuating anything, really. I'm just trying to help find who did this. He nodded, his eyes down. Knapp headed out the back door. She followed him. What's up? She asked. Aaron Corval. What about him? It isn't hard to use Google, he said. He was murdered days ago. That's right.
So you want to tell me what's going on?
Chapter 18
Simon's car route back to Manhattan ran past the Corval Inn and Family Tree Farm. He almost drove straight past it. What was the point? And he wanted to get back to the hospital, but then again, nothing ventured, nothing gained. He pulled into the lot and parked in the same spot he'd left earlier. The inn was quiet. If the mourners had all been heading to a reception when Enid peeled off for her club, the reception was over. He looked for any familiar faces at all, anyone who'd been at the memorial service down by the brook, but the only person who looked familiar was the woman behind the desk with the tablecloth-checked blouse. She had another map of the grounds flattened on the desk, and was showing a color-coordinated young couple that Simon would anachronistically call yuppies, the most arduous hiking trail on the property. The woman clearly spotted Simon waiting out of the corner of her eye, and she clearly wasn't happy about it. Simon stood, bouncing on his toes, and glanced around. There was a staircase on the right. He debated going up it, but what good would that do? There were glass doors covered with lace behind him. They would lead to another room. Maybe the reception was in there. As he started toward them, he heard the woman behind the desk say, "Excuse me, that room is private." Simon didn't stop. He reached the door, turned the knob, and pushed into the room. There had indeed been a reception of some sort in here. Debris from finger sandwiches and crudités sat on a stained white tablecloth in the center of the room. An antique roll-top desk, complete with those mail slots and tiny file drawers, was to Simon's right. Wiley Corval swiveled from the desk and rose.
What are you doing here?
The woman behind the desk came in behind Simon. I'm so sorry, Wiley.
It's okay, Bernadette. I got it.
Are you sure I can call?
I have it.
Close the door and see to our guests, please. She threw an eye dagger at Simon before heading back into the lobby. She closed the doors a little harder than necessary, shaking the glass.
What do you want? He asked Simon with a snap.
Wiley Corval now wore a brown herringbone tweed vest with pewter buttons. A gold chain hung from the middle button, attached, no doubt, to a pocket watch that was in the vest pocket. His crisp white shirt had puffy arms moving down to a tapered cuff. Dressed for the role of innkeeper, Simon thought. My daughter is missing.
You told me that already. I have no idea where she is. Please go away.
I have some questions, and I don't have to answer them. He stood a little straighter, threw back his shoulders for effect.
I'm mourning my son today.
There was no reason to be subtle.
Are you? Simon asked.
Surprise came to Wiley's face. Simon had expected that. But there was something deeper. Fear.
Am I what?
Aaron's father.
What are you talking about?
You don't look like him at all.
Wiley's mouth dropped open.
Are you serious?
Tell me about Aaron's mother.
He looked as though he were about to say something, caught himself, and then a smile crossed Wiley Corval's face. The smile was creepy. Extra creepy. Simon almost took a step back.
You've been talking to my wife.
Something occurred to Simon at that moment, something that perhaps Enid had been hinting at, or perhaps it was seeing Wiley in the flesh